In his new book, What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves, Benjamin Bergen explains not only why we love swearing, but also what it is that makes us use those starred, beeped, and censored words in the first place. He gives us our funniest, clearest study to date on swearing. A language and cognition expert, Bergen explains how profanity has the potential to expose how the language we use builds our social lives, mirrors and shapes our emotional selves, and how it bubbles forth from our brains. By treating profanity as part of normal human behavior and by applying the various tools of cognitive science to it, we discover things we never would have known otherwise. Benjamin Bergen is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. Again, the name of the book is What the F? And we welcome Benjamin Bergen to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
The pleasure is mine.
What led you to want to take a closer look at the swearing that we do in our lives?
Well, my research has always been about language and the brain. And I started to become interested in the emotional side of language. And there's nothing more emotional than the words that we use in moments of strongest anger, fear, surprise, joy. And so I wanted to dig a little bit deeper into the science of those words.
You have a statement in the book, and I'm just curious about that statement, which is that we love swearing. Is that true? Do we all love doing it? And what is there about it that we enjoy?
Well, I think we don't all enjoy it. And for many of us, it's a complicated set of emotions that we have around it. People generally report that when they swear, they do so as a means of emotional release. They do so when they are experiencing strong, transient emotions. And many people report that they experience a sort of catharsis, that they feel better, less stressed out, or less angry after they swear. But our experiences are textured by the history that we have with these same words. We grew up, most of us, being punished or being told that these words were inappropriate in certain contexts, and we take those lessons with us throughout all of our adulthood. So there's a lot more going on than just relief.
So keeping it radio-friendly, just take an example between the difference between damn and darn. And one, a child can get away with saying, and the other one, a child may not be able to get away with saying. And they're both words. So what does that tell us about the power of those individual words and the sounds that we put together? And what, in doing that, makes it so offensive to some people?
Yeah. Well, you hit the head on the nail there, the nail on the head. there's nothing about those sounds themselves, that sequence of does and ahs and ns, that make those words bad or that make them offensive. It's a whole socio-cultural legacy that we have. In this particular case, that derives from shared, you know, Judaic and Christian traditions involving the use of religious terminology and in public settings and how that's not appropriate, that we carry on with us, and that's why damn is thought to be inappropriate in certain circumstances. But the nature of the words isn't intrinsically good or bad. And in fact, over the course of our lifetimes, I think we're seeing that a word like damn might have been much more powerful in the last century than it is in this century, and probably our kids and our kids' kids will never even know that it was an offensive word to begin with. A lot like words that have fallen off already, like tarnation and gadzooks, which we don't have any particularly strong associations with, but which previous generations might have.
Although even in a setting now, you may get more of a reaction, if that's what you were seeking, from saying gadzooks than you would from saying the F word.
It would be a different kind of reaction. I mean, people, when they hear gadzooks, I think they're surprised because it's such an infrequent thing. When
yes.
People react to the F word, I think it's because of the strong emotional associations they have with other instances in which people have used that word.
Because that word in particular has permeated our society, and because we can find it readily on television and satellite radio and of course in just about every school bus in the country as well as schoolyard and water cooler, Does it lose its power at some point, or what is there about that particular word that continues to be something that will raise an eyebrow even though it is so frequently used?
It really does have staying power. It's been around for centuries, although not longer. In Shakespeare's time, it wasn't that bad a word at all. So over the last 3 or 4 centuries, it's been pretty bad. There's good evidence, though, that as you said, as language becomes democratized, then we see that these strongest words start to lose their oomph. And that's just the product of repeated exposure. You keep hearing these same words over and over through your Twitter feed or through online games that kids play, and the words stop having as much impact. And we can actually see this from surveys that have been conducted with younger adults who report that that particular word, that F word, isn't even in the top 10 worst words of English, according to North American English speakers. So it really is on its way out.
You make the point in the book, and I think it's a fascinating point, is that, and I want to go a little bit more into how these words impact children, but before we do that, you make the point that a lot of this has to do with whether it is used as a slur or not, mm-hmm. of whether it can be damaging as opposed to just being a word.
Right. Well, we know that there are different ways of using many of these words. Lots of them can be used as forms of verbal abuse, right? You to tell a child that he or she is worthless or stupid or bad can be accompanied by profanity, though it doesn't have to be, of course. And other types of harmful language, like you said, are slurs. So words that by their very nature are used to cause harm in many circumstances, to call someone out as being a member of a particular, you know, racial group or sexual orientation or whatever. And we know that these terms cause increased discrimination within a society. We can actually measure that in the lab. And we know that exposure to these terms and to verbal abuse in general is correlated with long-term decreases in child well-being. They report increased aggression and anxiety, depression, detachment from school when they're repeatedly exposed to abuse and to slurs. So those really are the strongest, most harmful things that can happen around children. But that same thing doesn't appear to be true of just run-of-the-mill profanity that you might shout out when you trip over a kitty gate in the middle of the night or when you slam your thumb in a door or something like that.
And the parents who are concerned that such language can cause their kids to become more aggressive or to even limit their vocabulary, the casual profanity, it does not seem to be the case that it can have that effect.
It's hard to prove a negative, but we've looked at a lot of studies that attempt to measure the effect of profanity on different sorts of childhood behaviors, and there's no evidence that there's any hint of an effect of swearing around children on their subsequent aggression or on their vocabulary size. In fact, the reverse is true, at least for vocabulary size. If you take kids who are no longer kids but are now adults, and they show up in my lab because they're undergraduate psychology students, and they have to for credit, they actually display greater capacities with the language in general if they also are more proficient at swearing. So it's almost the reverse is true there. So, yeah, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that these run-of-the-mill profanities cause direct harm to children or their vocabularies.
I love the phrase that you just used. What makes us proficient in swearing?
Well, I think many of the things that make us creative with language in general. I mean, I think that's why we see that young adults who are most have the most ease at bringing up profanities quickly to their tongue, that combine them in new and interesting ways, they also tend to be most interested in the language in general. And you find when you look at people whose job is language, whether that's academics who write papers for a living or journalists who also write for papers for a living, I think you find that there's a lot of creativity and joy that these people take with language, and that extends oftentimes to the dirty words as well.
When you look at the global nature of profanity, and having traveled some,
I mean, if you compare our country to others and going to parts of Europe, I mean, we're prudish, aren't we, in comparison to some of the language that is used in more public settings?
Yeah, you could maybe draw a line between that runs from France, where pretty much anything is permitted. The strongest words of the language that are equivalent to our F word, in fact, one of which starts with F, could appear on the floor of the Senate, and the President of the Republic could say it, and you can see it on afternoon television, and kids say it in schools and so on, and no one really bats an eyelash. And on the other end, you could imagine sort of the most repressive regime possible, a draconian approach to language where any offensive words are subject to extreme punishment. Russia is moving in that direction, for example. You can't use any of a list of words that are deemed to be profane in any sort of public media that includes journalism, art, and so on. But even farther, you can imagine places like Afghanistan and so on, where there's corporal punishment, where there's capital punishment for blasphemy. We're nowhere near as extreme as that. We fall somewhere in the middle, where we have pretty strong ideas about specific words that we want to call out as being inappropriate in particular contexts, and we have very strong beliefs about those words. Some people that I talk to, for example, just can't understand how I could possibly think that this wasn't a terrible thing to say this word. We have strong beliefs that are inculcated early in life that we accumulate over the lifespan. And we act in ways to suppress these words, whether through individual action, you know, soap in the mouth, or through a governmental action, so the FCC, which is monitoring our behavior right now. The current moment in North America is one where we have some language policy and we have some enforcement, more so than some places and less so than others.
To the question that you bring up in the subtitle of the book, What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves, what does the fact, if I am, to use your term, a proficient swearer, what does that tell the world about me?
Well, first of all, it tells you cultural things, the world cultural things about you, that you come from a place that has a notion of profanity in the first place. There are places in the world where that basic idea just doesn't have any purchase. So in Japan, for example, there are no bleeps on television for swear words because there aren't swear words. It's not like France where there are words that we generally agree are bad, but no one really cares. In Japan, there isn't a way to call someone the equivalent of the F word. There are words that mean things like foolish or silly or, you know, words for body parts, but they're kiddie words for body parts. So it tells us, first of all, something about the culture that we were raised in. Second, it tells us something about the way that we were raised in that culture. So were we raised to have beliefs about those words that they were evil and terrible and bad, or were we raised to believe that there are certain circumstances in which they can be used for productive purposes, like making people laugh or making yourself seem more accessible to a coworker, or venting your frustration that the traffic is so bad. And then finally, I guess it tells us what your current state is right now. What are the emotions that are flowing through your body? Because, of course, profanity reveals that more than anything else does about the way that we choose our words. It reveals that you are right now experiencing such a strong emotional state that your ability to inhibit yourself despite the social circumstances that might demand it, nevertheless, they're overcome by this strong emotional impulse. So it tells you a lot, actually.
The book does not seem to be anti-swearing, though.
No, it's not anti-swearing. I mean, it's certainly anti-certain ways of using language. I mean, I guess I sort of take a page out of George Carlin's book here, right? The words themselves are an object of study. I'm a scientist of language. I'm a cognitive scientist. What I do is I try to understand how language works in the brain and the mind. This isn't taking the page from Carlin. This is my page. But Carlin's page is... is that the words themselves are not intrinsically bad, that it's the ways that we use the words. Whether if we choose to use a word to harm, then we can cause harm. If we choose to use a word to sexually excite, then we can do that. I mean, we're humans, and we have the full range of human experiences to try to convey, and these strong words are just one thing that we use.
The name of the book is What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. Benjamin Bergen is a professor of cognitive science at the University of California, San Diego. Again, the name of the book is What the F. It is published by Basic Books. Benjamin Bergen, thank you very much for spending time with us. It's a great pleasure having you on the program.
It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, What the F. It is published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.